Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, science writer Sam Keen, starts his new book, Caesar's Last Breath, by asking you to indulge him in a modest experiment. Pay close attention to the air escaping your body, as if this were your last living breath on Earth. How much do you really know about this air? Feel your lungs deflate and sag inside your chest. Do we really know what's going on inside there? Well, your lungs expel a half liter of air with every normal breath, and breath is invisible. Without it, we would die in minutes. Sam Keen tells the story of the air we breathe in his new book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. He writes, "With every breath, you literally inhale the history of the world." Sam Keen is an award-winning science writer. His books, The Disappearing Spoon and The Violinist's Thumb, were national bestsellers. His stories have appeared in many publications, including The Atlantic and The New York Times. His latest book is Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. And Sam joins us from the Sioux Falls studio in South Dakota. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Really interesting book, something that, as you say, we don't talk enough about. But before we dive in and talk about breath and air, since you are a science writer, this is your third book about science, I just want to ask you what you think about the current war on science. The New York Times just ran an editorial called President Trump's War on Science. And they started off by writing about how on August 18th, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine received an order from the Interior Department to stop working on what seemed like an overdue study of the health risks of mountaintop removal coal mining. And then the piece just goes into budget cuts at NOAA. The budget calls for an elimination of NOAA's Coastal Research Program, $250 million. The list just goes on. As a science writer, what do you make of all of this?
It's frustrating. I'm not someone who covers a lot of politics, but you kind of have to be thinking about those kind of things nowadays, unfortunately. And yeah, it's just very frustrating to see these things. And in some sense, it's even wider than just talking about science. You could frame it even as sort of a disregard for truth in general and science just being a part of that. But it's really frustrating to see budget cuts like that, to see new administrative heads who were formerly suing the agencies that they're now leading, like the EPA. Rick Perry had proposed eliminating the Department of Energy and then became the head of the Department of Energy. And, you know, it just goes on and on. So it's frustrating to see, and it's scary in some ways as well.
The New York Times piece reports that at the Department of Agriculture, staff members are encouraged to use words like weather extremes instead of climate change, and build soil organic matter, increase nutrient use efficiency instead of reduce greenhouse gases. The Department of Energy has scrubbed the words clean energy and new energy from their websites. And then you have a proposed cut of about $6 billion from the National Institutes of Health, which is the country's single largest funder of biomedical research. And Sam, I'm sure you are aware of the scientists who marched on Washington. A lot of scientists say, you know what, it's time to get political. How do you feel as a science writer, and what are you hearing from fellow science writers?
Again, it's a sense of frustration and not knowing how far things are going to go, hoping they stop, you know, just getting disappointed again and again, and hoping that, you know, they can take action to try to stem some of the problems that we're seeing.
As someone who writes about things like air and breath and the history of this, and has done extensive research, what effects do you think this will have on, for example, education around science?
Well, I mean, that's something coming up in the future. I mean, hopefully we can sort of stem the damage. Again, I don't write a lot about politics. I don't focus on that. I'm kind of more of a science history writer, I guess, you know, telling science stories and things. But again, you just have to kind of face these realities nowadays.
Well, how did you come up with this concept around your new book to write about air and breath? As you say, this is something that we all just take for granted. We don't spend much time thinking about the air that we breathe.
Yeah, with all of my books, I've written three other ones beside this one. What I really try to do is kind of have a central idea, something like the periodic table or the human genome, but then really spin off a lot of stories about that, about all areas of human life, things like war or crime or art or food, other things that you might not think to link to those initial ideas. And with The Air, I knew that there were a lot of great stories out there that I could go into and talk about a lot of really fun, interesting things that you might not think to connect with the atmosphere or the air we're breathing, because, you know, the air is around us all the time. We're sort of generally aware it's important, but because it's invisible and even because it's ubiquitous around us, we kind of neglect it in some ways.
You say that if you stop people on the street and ask them about the air they breathe and what it is, you'll get a wildly different answers.
Yeah, some people want to focus on sort of the big picture where they talk about the atmosphere as a whole and the air around the world. Some people talk about the individual molecules, these very tiny little bits of matter floating around. Other people talk about environmental concerns or something like that, or they talk about, you know, the air quality, things like that. And all of those things are true. And what the book tries to do in some ways is to give you different perspectives and try to show you all of those perspectives at different times. So when you walk away from it, I think besides the fun, interesting stories, you're going to have a much more holistic perspective on what the air is and what you're constantly bringing into your own body, breathing it in and out all day, every day.
When you sat down to start the research process, where did you begin? What did you really set out to do when you decided to write a book about air and the air we breathe?
Well, with all of my books, the first thing I want to do is make sure that the stories are going to be good, that they're going to be interesting for people. I want to have characters. I want to have heroes. I want to have villains. There should be conflict and drama and a resolution or a crisis of some sort. So I really focus on those. And then the science is part of the story, an important part of the story. But I really look at them as human stories, first and foremost. So when I'm sitting down, kind of collecting the ideas for it, I really want to make sure the stories there first, and then the science will kind of take care of itself, I think, once you get writing the story.
It was interesting to learn that for a long time, people really didn't think about air. You write that when they did think about air, they thought of it as a spiritual thing.
Yeah, it was almost like sort of this spiritual substance around us. They didn't have the idea that we have nowadays that air is matter. It's a thing, and that there are different components in the air. You can talk about nitrogen and oxygen and ozone and the different parts of the air. People didn't have that idea for a very, very long time until the 1700s, really. So even though we knew the air existed in some sense, we really didn't have a good idea of what it actually was for a very long time. And even during that period, it was still a little hazy on what exactly it was. The word for gas actually comes from the word for chaos in Greek, because they didn't know what this stuff was. It just seemed like this random chaotic thing, and they really had a hard time kind of wrapping their head around it for quite a while.
You have an interesting story about three scientists who discovered oxygen in the late 1700s, and things didn't turn out so well for these scientists. One scientist accidentally poisoned himself. Another one instigated a riot. And then the third scientist was beheaded during the French Revolution. Tell us about these three and what they discovered.
So they were the first ones to discover that the air had oxygen in it. Other scientists before them had discovered a few other gases in the air, but they were the ones who get credit historically for discovering oxygen. The first one was named Carl Scheele. He was a Swedish scientist. And unfortunately, he was kind of isolated and a little naive. He really didn't know how to publicize his results, how to get them out to other scientists. And unfortunately for him, he died obscure, not really getting credit in his lifetime for discovering oxygen. And he also accidentally poisoned himself in his lab and ended up dying in sort of this horrible, racking pain in his body. So he was the first one, didn't end well for him. The second scientist was sort of a rabble-rouser and preacher named Joseph Priestley, active in England. And he used to study science on the side in his home in what he called his e-laboratory. So instead of laboratory, he called it his e-laboratory, which is kind of a nice name. And he ended up discovering oxygen independently. But he, again, was a rabble-rouser, ended up instigating a riot in Birmingham, got burned in effigy, his house got destroyed, and he actually ended up getting exiled to the United States. He was a good friend of Benjamin Franklin and some other people, so they welcomed him in, and he ended up dying in exile in Pennsylvania in the early 1800s. But he was the second one. And then the third one was a scientist named Antoine Lavoisier, a French scientist, and he ended up getting beheaded during the French Revolution. So he probably came to the worst end of all of them in some ways. So there was kind of this curse on oxygen where all of the people involved in its early discovery ended up either dying or ending their lives in exile.
And again, they discovered that we breathe oxygen in. And it's also just interesting to focus on things like oxygen and nitrogen. And reading your book made me realize that I didn't have a very good chemistry teacher in high school, unfortunately. But it's so interesting to learn that oxygen has a very strange effect on a certain group of animals, particularly insects, because they don't have lungs that work the same way that our lungs work.
Yeah, so mammals, reptiles, birds, we all have lungs. So we inhale, the oxygen diffuses into our blood, and then the blood distributes the oxygen to our inner cells. Insects, their breathing doesn't work like that. Basically, they have pores on their skin, and the oxygen just sort of passively diffuses into their pores. And that actually explains why insects are always so tiny, why you don't get big, huge insects the way you do big mammals and big birds and big reptiles, is because that passive breathing process of it flowing through their skin is kind of inefficient. So the oxygen can't really get into their deep interior cells. But if you look at the history of Earth, right now, the oxygen level in the air is about 21%, so about one of every five molecules we breathe is oxygen. But in the history of Earth, it has been as high as 35% oxygen. And when oxygen levels are much higher like that, the breathing process for insects suddenly becomes more efficient, and insects can suddenly get much larger. And if you look at the geological record, you can see millipedes that are a yard long. You can see dragonflies the size of seagulls. You can see spiders the size of car tires. All of a sudden, you get these gigantic, creepy crawlies running around simply because the oxygen level in the air was higher. So it's a subtle change, but one that has a very dramatic effect on the evolution of insects and other creatures. So right now, we should be kind of thankful that it's just at 21%.
Well, the evolution of oxygen for insects is really interesting, but the evolution of oxygen itself is interesting because, as you report, early Earth had no oxygen. We had to evolve to get oxygen.
Yeah, early Earth had no oxygen gas on it. And in fact, life arose on Earth well before oxygen gas existed in the air. And in fact, most creatures, or I guess I should say most microbes, who lived at the time when oxygen was starting to build up, to them, oxygen was a poison. It was a deadly gas, the way that chlorine would be a deadly gas to us today if we tried to breathe it. And oxygen, because it started building up as a byproduct of other processes that the microbes were undergoing, things like photosynthesis, they would release oxygen. They would expel it because it was a poison. It would start to build up in the air. And eventually, the oxygen levels got so high a few billion years ago that it started wiping out huge swaths of microbes and, in fact, killed off most of the microbes who existed then. Geologists call it the Great Oxygen Catastrophe because life on Earth very nearly got wiped out by oxygen gas, something we consider vital for life on Earth today.
Do we know how did life forms eventually learn to tame oxygen? How did that happen?
Yeah. It's a little rough because, it happened so long ago, but probably what happened, if you look at our cells inside our bloodstream, we have hemoglobin molecules in our red blood cells, and they have iron atoms at the middle of them, And the iron atoms can grab onto oxygen, and they can keep it confined. They can sort of harness it, and they don't let it sort of roam around independently inside the body. And somewhere along the line, billions of years ago, some mutations happened to some lucky microbe. They figured a way to produce some sort of metal or something, iron, magnesium, whatever, where they could actually hold on to the oxygen. And the reason why oxygen is so deadly to a lot of microbes is that it's a very powerful, very reactive gas. It's sort of like dynamite or something nowadays, where dynamite can be great. It can do a lot of really great things, but you have to be very careful about how you deploy the dynamite. So some lucky microbe figured out a way to harness and control the dynamite to take advantage of all the energy that's packed inside of it. And once they did figure out how to do that, gave them a big opportunity, and evolution took over from there. Suddenly you have, a few hundred million years later, or maybe even longer than that, you have creatures like us that can run and jump and think, that really need oxygen in order to do the great things that we do.
Wow.
So this poison ended up being kind of a what allowed complex life on Earth to exist.
And here we are today. One of every five molecules we breathe is oxygen. Is that right?
Yep.
Today we're speaking with Sam Keen about his new book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. Sam writes that with every breath you take, you literally inhale the history of the world. But this isn't something we spend that much time talking about or thinking about. How much do you really know about air? Do you know what's really happening when you breathe in and out? What happens when you take short breaths and long breaths? And if you have any questions for Sam about the air that we breathe, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Sam, before we get into more interesting stories, what did you learn about what happens when we breathe? And how did that affect you? Because when I was reading your book and listening to a few of your talks, I was thinking a lot about breath, because a lot of doctors have said that if you deal with a lot of stress, and a lot of us are dealing with stress right now, to really take very deep breaths, because it has a very positive effect on your nervous system, and it brings your stress levels down. But you have to be conscious of it.
Yeah, it's a kind of a relaxing thing to do. It's a relaxation mechanism. So you breathe in deeply, you kind of get more oxygen inside you. And it is a mindfulness thing, too, where you're just paying attention to your breath. You're kind of blocking out other distractions. So it's a physiological thing where, you know, you're getting the oxygen, kind of giving your body a little boost that way, but also a psychological thing where you are paying attention, kind of, again, blocking the distractions, things like that. So being aware of your breathing and what you're doing while you're breathing can help with those kind of things.
Let's talk a little bit about nitrogen. Without nitrogen, life as we know it could not exist. It makes up about 78% of our atmosphere, and four of every five molecules we breathe is a nitrogen molecule.
Yeah, the important thing about nitrogen is that if you look at the history of Earth, we've had roughly four different types of atmospheres over Earth's history. The air is a lot like a living thing in that it evolves and changes over time. And one of the early atmospheres on Earth was basically a bunch of volcano exhaust. So you had a bunch of nasty things like hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg smell, and you had ammonia and other gases, a lot of carbon dioxide, you know, that would heat things up. And that was not a very welcoming atmosphere for life, because these gases are very energetic, very reactive, probably would have destroyed a lot of the incipient life forms that were trying to get established on early Earth. Eventually, nitrogen gas took over and became the dominant gas in the atmosphere. And that's good for us because nitrogen is a very benign gas, very unreactive. So it basically gave this nice safe blanket over the Earth that allowed life to sort of crawl up on land and to exist on land. Because if we still had that nasty reactive volcano exhaust for an atmosphere, it's very hard to see how you could get a lot of complex life on land, because it would just be very difficult for creatures to even exist here with all of those kind of reactive gases floating around.
What happens if these levels rise, the levels of oxygen and nitrogen that we breathe in, or rise or drop?
Well, if they rise or drop, that'll affect the pressure of the atmosphere, which can affect various processes. Oxygen level, that would be the one that we would really need to worry about if something really dramatic were to happen and oxygen were to disappear. Even if oxygen levels drop to something like 16-17% as opposed to the 21% they are now, it gets a little hard for people to breathe. We really struggle at that point. We feel very sluggish. Our thinking slows down. So having that nice balance of 21% is really beneficial to us. We kind of need to keep it there. And also, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, having higher oxygen levels can affect the evolution of creatures like insects, where all of a sudden you get gigantic insects. So oxygen, I think, would be the one that would probably, if that level changed a lot, would really affect the what life is like on Earth.
Today, we are joined by Sam Keane, author of the new book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. And Sam writes about the air that we breathe and says, with every breath you take, you are really decoding the secrets of air around you. And he says that it's the story of Earth and our existence on it. Tell us about the title of your book, Sam, Caesar's Last Breath.
Yeah, so that's kind of a classic challenge problem that professors often give to chemistry and physics students, where they say, I want you to figure out what the odds are that you are breathing a molecule that Julius Caesar exhaled during his last breath while he was being assassinated. And I think for most of us, when we hear that that thought experiment, that challenge problem, our first instinct is that's impossible. There's no way that any of Caesar's last breath could still be around. I mean, breath is about the most ephemeral thing you could ever imagine. And a single breath is so tiny compared to the whole gigantic atmosphere that it seems impossible. There could be nothing left of Caesar's breath. But if you look at it from a different perspective, you start to wonder a little bit, because first of all, in any one breath, there are so many molecules in it. It's something like 25 sextillion molecules, which is a 25 with 21 zeros after it. Just this gargantuan number of molecules. And also, the molecules are mostly nitrogen molecules, which, as I mentioned, are very hardy, very unreactive molecules. So they stick around in the air for a very long time, certainly more than the 2,000 years that have passed since Caesar died. And if you look at the numbers, I get into it in the book a little bit more, but if you look at all of the conditions and everything, you work the numbers out, it turns out that everything cancels almost exactly. And the odds are that you are breathing a molecule of Julius Caesar's last breath every single time you take a breath. So that's a really crazy thing to think about, that, you know, Julius Caesar's body is long gone. Most of the buildings near where he assassinated have fallen down and sort of crumbled into dust. But Julius Caesar's breath, of all things, is still floating around, and we're still breathing it in all of the time. So it's really this direct material connection with history that you would never think to make just through the air around us. And there's really no reason you have to restrict yourself to Julius Caesar either. You could think about Amelia Earhart or Confucius or whoever your hero is in history. You're breathing some of that person's last breath as well.
You have an interesting example of your mom and the breath that she took in. One of the chapters of your book deals with nuclear fallouts, and you talk about radioactive particles in the air from nuclear weapons. And you write, consider my mother, who had several demographic strikes against her. She grew up in the 1950s in rural Iowa, which got peppered with far higher concentrations of fallout than population centers along the coasts. Most of my mom's exposure would have come from drinking milk contaminated with strontium-90 and worse, iodine-131, another common fission product. Like strontium, iodine is absorbed by plants and concentrated in cow's milk. Breast milk also contains a appreciable amounts, as do cottage cheese, eggs, and leafy vegetables. Talk a little bit about this this part of the book, when you write about your mom and also what happened with nuclear fallouts and how people like your mom were affected by that and inhaling some of that contaminated air.
Yeah, so this had to do with nuclear weapons testing in the 1950s, mostly, when they were doing it in Nevada. And just based on prevailing weather and wind patterns, most of that sort of blew east, and a lot of it ended up falling over Iowa, which is where my mom was growing up at the time. Grew up in kind of a rural area, so they would drink milk from, you know, the backyard cows and things. And it ended up increasing the amount of radioactivity in the air, the amount of radioactive particles that we breathe. And I should emphasize, you know, that even if these weapons tests had never happened, we'd still be breathing in radioactive particles. There are radioactive particles all around us in your granite countertop. You know, glossy magazines have a little bit. Bananas have a certain amount of them. So everything has a little bit of radioactivity in it. But these weapons testing, it ended up boosting the amount of radioactivity. And especially for children who were growing up at the time, that ended up affecting them. And in the book, I talk about some of the consequences that we're likely to see over the long term because of this boost in radioactive particles, things like health problems, cancer rates. It's not going to be some sort of epidemic, but there are people who are going to get cancer that probably wouldn't have otherwise based on this. We can just learn this statistically.
And let's talk about that after the break. Today, we're speaking with science writer Sam Keen about his new book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're speaking with science writer Sam Keen about his new book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. Sam is a best-selling author, and his stories have appeared in the Best American Science and Nature Writing and the New York Times. And if you have a question or comment for Sam about the air that we breathe, this is something that we don't spend that much time talking about or thinking about, but it is so incredibly important for obvious reasons. Without air, we could not survive. But how much do you know about the air that you breathe? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And what about changing air? I was thinking when I was reading Sam's book about the heat wave that we had a couple of weekends ago and how the air was just so cloudy and dark because of all the fires that we had. And there were a lot of stories online about how to deal with that. People were coughing and choking because we're not used to that air. So what are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before the break, Sam, we were talking about nuclear fallouts and radioactive particles in the air from, for example, nuclear weapons testing. And you were talking about health effects. And you write that the concentration of the carbon-14 in the air between 1950 and 1963, which added more than a trillion pounds to the air, has not dropped back to normal and will not for 1,000 years. Can you talk about why? How does this happen exactly?
So basically, we have to wait out the carbon that gets in the air. The biggest radioactive species that these bombs were producing over the long term would be carbon-14. They often use it in carbon dating. Archaeologists use it. Can be a very useful tool, but it does get into the atmosphere after these nuclear weapons tests and ends up just kind of hanging around in the atmosphere. Has a half-life of around 5,700 years, so you have to wait that long for half of it to disappear. Some of it does sort of get sucked up into plants and other things, but a lot of it we're just going to have to kind of wait around for it to disappear over the long term.
Would you say we've done shows about the importance of trees on the planet, especially in urban mm-hmm. areas? Is this one of the reasons why greenery is so important?
It is one of the reasons. I would say there are probably bigger reasons why greenery is important, especially nowadays. Trees and other plants can act as a carbon sink. So they are getting all carbon dioxide, helping to get all of it out of the atmosphere. So removing the radioactive bits is good, but even more than that, just sort of absorbing the excess carbon dioxide compared to before the Industrial Revolution, that's kind of an even bigger benefit. Besides the fact that, you know, trees are gorgeous and we want them around. We enjoy having trees.
Right.
So it's both a pleasure and a benefit to us.
As you report, you have a higher chance of getting cancer than you would otherwise, even if you were born after the test ban treaty. How much higher? You write that depending on the assumptions you make, the extra carbon-14 was inducing between 100,000 and a million extra DNA mutations per person per day as late as 1990. What else did you learn about the health effects? I mean, the thing that's so frustrating about cancer is that you can't pinpoint it. When people get cancer, you can't say, well, this is why you got it.
Right, exactly. So it is a statistical thing where you can't point to any one person and say, you got cancer because of this. And, you know, the DNA mutations, that sounds really scary, but we all have natural mutations, many more natural mutations that happen each day to us as well. So it does get really tricky to kind of sort those things out. Mm-hmm. But they can go back, they can look at rates in the past, and they can try to tease out how many roughly extra cases we think will occur because of it. And you've had scientists who have done this, who've written peer-reviewed articles talking about it, and they have teased out roughly the numbers that they think, a few thousand cases.
I don't know if you dove into this, but I find it fascinating because doctors, nutritionists will say that we all have cancer cells in our bodies, and we always hear things like, you know, eat more broccoli, eat more greens, because they will counteract the cancer cells. Did you research any of that in your book or in any of your last books?
I do talk a little bit about the effects of broccoli and other things on different, like going through the digestive system and mm-hmm. things like that. So not necessarily with cancer. You know, I don't do a lot of health reporting. I'm always a little skeptical that there are superfoods out there that are all of a sudden going to wipe out every problem that we have and cure a bunch of diseases.
Right.
Eating healthier in general is obviously quite good for you. So I would encourage people to do that. But as far as, you know, just like eliminating cancer or something like that, I'd be a little skeptical that you would just, you know, be able to eat more broccoli and everything would be perfect.
Right. Well, they don't say that. They just say you should eat more broccoli regardless.
Okay. All right.
All right. We have an email from Melissa who says, you're talking about breathing now, but there are so many different types of breathing being recommended currently. I read that we used to breathe out and let the air rush in like a bellows, and that this is a more efficient way of breathing, and that babies do this, but then learn somehow not to do that. It really doesn't feel natural. So is it? She asks.
Oh, okay. I had not heard that about babies and about their breathing. I do know babies can do other things. You know, they can, like, swallow and breathe at the same time and do these sort of things that seem impossible for adults. But, no, I had not heard that about how breathing possibly changes as we grow up.
What else did you learn about the act of breathing that surprised you?
I think it was more that I just really became aware of what the air was in general. So less about, you know, the actual physical act of breathing and more about just what it was that I was breathing. We talked a little bit about how oxygen's about 21%, nitrogen's about 78%. So that makes up 99% of the air already. And I think, like some people, I kind of had the idea, well, you know, that's 99% of the air. So that other 1% probably can't be that important, can't be doing that much. But it turns out there are really fascinating stories about that extra 1%. All of global warming comes from not just that 1%, but even less, a smaller percent of that 1%. All scents, all odors, all smells, you know, barbecues or perfume, things like that. All of that comes from that 1% as well. So there is this trace component of the atmosphere that really gives it a lot of its character, a lot of its pizzazz. And even though it's numerically small, it has kind of an outside influence. So just being aware of those things and what we're breathing all the time, I think really got me more interested the more I looked at it.
How does climate change affect the air that we breathe. I was talking earlier about the fires that happened a couple of weeks ago in California, and I mean, people were coughing when they went outside. But how is climate change changing the air we breathe?
Yeah, I was actually in Portland and Seattle not too long ago giving some book talks, and you would go outside and there was a white sky and kind of this blood red sun even in the afternoon. It was really, really startling to see. So with climate change, you're talking about certain gases, things like carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, chlorofluorocarbons, that are really good at absorbing heat. And basically what they do is they trap the heat. They don't let it escape from the surface of the earth the way that they would. And over time, since the Industrial Revolution, and especially in the past 50 years or so, the level of those gases has been increasing. And the world is getting warmer as a result. And sort of toward the end of the book, it made me think of it when you were talking about the wildfires. Toward the end of the book, I talk about some of the ways that people think they can combat this. Things like trying to strip carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, or what they call geoengineering. So doing things like spraying sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere to reflect sunlight back into space. And one of the effects of spraying sulfur dioxide, in addition to possibly making the Earth cooler, would be that it could change the color of our sky. It could sort of make it a milky white color instead of the nice blue that we're used to. And when I was walking around in Portland and Seattle, I just kept thinking about that. Like, wow, this is, you know, if we go down that road, if we're forced to go down that road, this could be what the sky looks like in the future. So in the book, I talk about that, some of these choices we have to face about whether we want to be more active about trying to combat the levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere doing things like that, and some of the consequences of that.
And do you think that we'll be forced to take that route? Because we've had a couple debates on this show about geoengineering.
Yeah. I don't mean to be a cynical person. I don't think I'm a cynical person by nature, but just being pragmatic about it and thinking, you know, what life is like for human beings, the nature of human beings, the fact that there are billions of people in places like China and India who are rising into the middle class, they are going to be consuming more. It's a little hard for us to tell them they just have to stop and hit pause on their development. I think that we're going to have to start looking very seriously at some of these geoengineering options. I should make it clear, I don't think these are good options. I'm not some sort of like wild-eyed technologist. But just from a pragmatic point of view, I think we're probably going to have to start looking at them sometime over the next century or so.
Yeah, I just heard someone, I think it was yesterday, say that the demand for meat on the planet is going to double by the year 2050. Because of population explosions around the world, access to money, that is just, it's hard to wrap your head around that.
Yeah, and even things like plastics or, you know, all these little things that have sort of infiltrated our life, we kind of take them for granted. But a lot of them are based on oil or, you know, other things that end up leaking into the atmosphere. And unfortunately, a lot of them are greenhouse gases. And it's sort of, this process is slowly, we're starting to see it, the effects nowadays.
Since we're talking about climate change, just quickly on this one, whenever we do a show about what we're dealing with right now, our guests, every single one of them, say we have to embrace green technology. We have to embrace solar panels, wind energy, that kind of thing, electric cars. What are your thoughts on these new sources of energy?
You know, I think we really need to work hard on developing them, and we need to figure out which ones of them are going to be capable of supplying the energy that we need. Unfortunately, some of them are inefficient, especially right now. So they need development, and we need to work on them and really get them going. I don't have answers, unfortunately. I would either, you know, I'd be probably in Stockholm picking up a Nobel Prize if I knew the answers and where this technology should go, what we need to do with it. But I think that has to be a part of the answer. I don't think it's going to be the answer, but definitely a part of the answer.
Today we're joined by science writer Sam Keen. He is out with a new book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. And Sam says that we should pay closer attention to the air that's escaping our body as if this were our last living breath, how much do you really know about your air? What is really going on when your lungs deflate and sag inside of your chest? Of course, without air, we would die in minutes. And this is not something we spend that much time thinking about, but there are so many interesting stories around this. And if you have any questions for Sam, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Phil in Palo Alto. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rose. I had two questions for Sam. One on the immediate topic of the atmosphere is, what are the best estimates for how long the various greenhouse gases are at current levels and projected levels? How long are they going to be in the atmosphere? And what's going to happen in 1,000 years when those gases, or however long it takes, are reabsorbed? And then the second question is more related to his book on the periodic table. And I'd just like if he could just touch on, I always thought the periodic table was credited to Mendeleev, but I learned about a guy named Harry Moseley who played a crucial role in revising it. And we don't know of him because he died in World War One. But if Sam could touch on Harry Moseley and Moseley's ladder, that would be great.
Yeah, so your first question about the gases in the atmosphere depends on which one you're talking about. Carbon dioxide, nitrous, chlorofluorocarbons, each one of them lasts for a different amount of time before it reacts with something and kind of falls out. So, I think carbon dioxide is maybe a few thousand years or something like that. Other gases disappear more quickly than that. The problem isn't so much that the gases are in the atmosphere, because eventually they will disappear, as much as we keep putting more in there. So as much as they disappear, more and more keep coming. So it's more the whole supply thing as opposed to the fact that, you know, they won't disappear for a long time. About the periodic table, that was from my book, The Disappearing Spoon. And yes, you're right that there were actually many other people, 5 other people, besides Mendeleev, who came up with the idea of the periodic table. I talk about them a little bit in the book, why they didn't get credit for it the same way that Mendeleev did. And you're talking about Henry Moseley there, the British scientist, who came along later. The periodic table was well established at that point, but what he did was he figured out a very quick and easy way to identify elements and figure out where there were gaps on the periodic table. And unfortunately, he died when he was only in his 20s. He sort of, against a lot of people's advice, volunteered for service in World War One, ended up dying tragically in Turkey, and science lost a really great mind when he did that.
Mm. Well, thank you for the phone call, Phil. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about air, the air we breathe, its connections to history, breath, we'd love to hear from you. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. We have an email from Larry who says, I just wanted to share the thought that while breathing is something we usually take for granted because our bodies do it automatically, breathing is actually the one body function that we have the most conscious control over. We can control how fast or slow, shallow or deep we breathe compared to our heart rate, blood pressure, etc. Our breath is the easiest way to connect the mind and body and ultimately our spirit, hence the focus of breathing techniques in meditations, chanting, singing, etc.
That's a good point. Yeah, you don't think about that, but he's exactly right. It is one of the few normally automatic processes that we can kind of break down and think about and actually control. Yeah.
Has this changed the way you think about your breath after writing this book, or changed the way, like, before you go to bed at night or when you wake up in the morning, to take time to actually focus on your breath?
Well, again, it's more, I think, more about the atmosphere itself. So less focus on me and more focus on the big world that's out there around us and engaging with all these amazing stories. I mean, we've talked a lot about, you know, things like climate change and things in this book, but I really look at the book as a story book where I want to tell stories about, there's a story about Albert Einstein inventing a new type of refrigerator. There are stories about the ozone layer and how it helped fuel the Roswell alien scare in the 1940s. Stories about Charles Dickens and spontaneous combustion. Those, for me, were really the meat of the book and what I focused on and why I got excited about writing the book. So when I think about the air nowadays, I think about those stories and really how those stories change my perspective on the atmosphere, on my own breathing, but also on just what history is like and how the air has shaped history, shaped the Industrial Revolution and everything about human civilization in so many different ways. So the stories were what really got me excited.
Yeah, we'll have to do a show on stress because we're getting a lot of emails about breath and how that affects our stress. You also write about Fritz Haber, and he's got a really interesting story. He was a young chemist in Germany in 1900, and he wanted to figure out how to feed our growing population. That's something we think about today. But tell us a little bit about Fritz Haber and what you learned about him.
Yeah, so at the time, very early 1900s, there was a growing demand for food, and scientists realized they needed to make fertilizers. And one of the big elements you need in fertilizer is nitrogen. Well, there's a lot of nitrogen in the air, but it's really hard to do something with that nitrogen to make it useful. And Fritz Haber was the one who figured out how to take the nitrogen in the air, turn it into a chemical that then could be turned into fertilizer. So what people said is that he turned the air into bread. He figured out how to make the air a useful product for fertilizer, ended up feeding billions and billions of people. Roughly half the people on Earth today would not be here without Fritz Haber. So on the one hand, he seems like one of the great heroes in science history, except during World War I, he was sort of a jingoistic person. He loved Germany, and he ended up instigating the awful gas warfare that we think about associated with World War I. And ended up terrorizing millions of soldiers because he made this gas warfare so awful. Things like mustard gas, chlorine. So he kind of goes down in history as this figure that has almost a contradictory legacy, where he saved billions and billions of people's lives over history, but he was also essentially a terrorist during this war, World War I, and destroying a lot of people's lives by killing them with poisonous gas. And interestingly enough, he was Jewish and ended up getting run out of Germany when the Nazis took over in the 1930s. But what they did is they took one of his gases, an insecticide called Zyklon A. They ended up adapting it, turned it into what's now called Zyklon B. And that was the gas that the Nazis used in the gas chambers to kill millions and millions of people, including some of Haber's relatives. So this gas he ended up inventing ended up turning around and kind of biting him back. And it's really just this fascinating tale of how science can do such wonderful, amazing things and how science can do some pretty awful things as well. So one of my favorite stories in the book.
It is interesting because you write that he unleashed these weapons on his fellow human beings with glee.
Yeah, he was really just a huge German patriot and just thought that he was going to basically end the war and basically become this huge hero in Germany. He always felt a bit like an outsider, like he was never quite accepted. And he thought if he did this, he would finally be accepted in Germany. And it's just strange to think about, you know, someone's just their inner anxieties and insecurities driving them to such an extent where they would start to do something like invent gas warfare. So he's a fascinating, fascinating case, both psychologically and scientifically.
And this connects all the way to today in Syria, for example.
Yeah, and I talk a little bit about in the book about how why gas warfare is so awful to us, why we think that these attacks are just uniquely horrible, even though by some objective standards, and Haber pointed this out, you know, guns and shells and bombs kill far, far more people in any given war than gas warfare ever did or probably ever could. But breathing is so important to us psychologically. We really get panicked if we can't breathe. It's so deep-seated, this anxiety in us. And I really think that that's why gas warfare seems so awful, because when we think about not being able to breathe, that is just a deep-seated panic that we cannot get over. And I think gas warfare taps into that, and that's why it seems like such a horrible thing.
Mm. Sam, we don't have time to take Phil, but he wanted to ask you, I'm sorry, Jack, he wanted to know, what about the quality of the air around us today?
The quality of the air around us, it depends on where you live exactly. In some ways, it's getting better. So I don't want everyone to think that everything is just doom and gloom and nothing can ever get better, because you see less smoggy days in a lot of cities. You see the ozone layer starting to recover some. So there have been some good developments over the past few decades. But unfortunately, you do see the levels of greenhouse gases rising too. So we've done some good things, but there are other things we need to do as well.
Sam Keen is a best-selling science writer. His latest book is Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. Really great story, Sam. Thank you so much for writing this book, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.